Good evening. I am perfectionistic, alcoholic, Lutheran, retired preacher. And to get this right, I wrote it down. Okay. I'm an alcoholic, and I belong to my home group, which is the Metro Sober Purpose Group in Montgomery, Alabama. My sobriety date is May the 26th, 1974, and I'm Russ. How you doing? Glad to meet all of you here tonight. I heard when they gave the announcement before that there were some Al-Anons here. Is that correct? Could you raise your hand for a minute so that we know? Look at those hands going up. Okay. That's great. I have a message for Al-Anons here tonight. In case of fire, remain seated until the AAs clear the room. Yeah. That's pitiful, isn't it? Okay. But I got to tell you, the Al-Anons really have a touch about this. Now, Eileen came out to the airport to pick us up. I have never seen her before in my life. She has never seen us. We got off the airplane, and we're walking down whatever they call that place, the aisle there. And some lady walked up and said, "Are you Russ?" I said, "Yes." She recognized that Al-Anon touch is fabulous, isn't it? I mean, they know how to see and to recognize the alcoholics right on the spur of the moment. So, okay. I always like to start my sharing with people by telling you that you're looking at a person up here tonight who is truly grateful. I know that I belong to a fellowship of men and women who love me, people who have accepted me as I am, people who have trusted me to be honest and open-minded and willing, and people who have been with me side by side as I learned how to become a responsible person. I also know that I belong to a God of my understanding who has loved me with an unconditional love, someone who has given to me a protection and an encouragement and an inspiration to return to sanity and to become the kind of person that he intended me to be in the first place. And for that, I am truly grateful. I'll walk around today with an attitude in my life that's seeking to care and daring to give before I die, I will finally live. And I hope that I do that every day, little by little, and so forth and so on. I have read a lot of stuff in the big book. I always carry a little one with me. This is 12 and 12. Kind of keeps you mindful of who you are and what you are. It's in my bedroom. I don't sleep with it, but it's nearby, and that helps. But I've read a lot of things in the big book about alcoholics. And one of the things that always impressed me was that it says that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we believe is the root of our troubles. Above all else, we alcoholics must deal with this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. But you see, that wasn't I. That was not me. They were talking about somebody else. Because when I was drinking, I was the greatest. I was the most important person in the whole world. I was the individual who had the biggest ego. I was the one who could solve anybody's problems in the church, and I guess I couldn't take care of my own. But let me tell you, that was all on the outside. Could I share with you what was on the inside? That I was scared, that I was immature, that I was a very insecure person, that I was just an absolute pig for recognition, and that I was one of the most hypersensitive people that you'd ever meet in the world. And whenever somebody said something about me, or if somebody implied that I was less than perfect, I would just simply go to pieces. And I would almost hate them because they felt that way. Okay. I also lived with a woman. Hello, Barbara. in my house, whom over a period of years I learned to call a psycho bitch. Sorry, dear. Our book reminds us, you know, that and I heard a couple of our speakers before mention this, that we come to that pitiful, incomprehensible state of demoralization of our lives, but that wasn't I. I was in charge of everything. I was okay. A few little detours along the way as far as alcohol and stuff like that was concerned. A lot of problems that I had to deal with in my life, but that was it. But that was all on the outside. What I was on the inside is that I was absolutely miserable. I was unhappy. I hated myself. And I really came to believe after I got into the program that what it said was true, that we are simply bent on self-destruction. I hated me, and I wanted to get rid of me. And I didn't really know how to do that. But when I drank, I was okay. I'm the kind of person that when I was brought up, you know, I always felt this way, even though I had brothers and sisters, a wonderful mother, father who drank a lot and things like that. But I was never good enough for anybody. I was never smart enough. I was never wise enough. I was never cool enough. I was never anything enough. But I need to tell you that when I drank, and I did, I was everything. I was perfect. Nobody could touch me. And if somebody would dare to raise their voice in opposition to anything that I wanted to do or anything that I felt, I'd get rid of them. I'd do them in. But I noticed that over the years, after 15 years of drinking out of control and life falling apart, that some really strange things were beginning to happen as far as my life was concerned. I remember that one time my lovely psycho bitch called the district president of my church and told him everything that was going on with me. And she invited him out to the place where we lived. And one morning I got up, you know, with a big hangover. And she said, did I forget to tell you that President Hopple is coming to see you today? And I thought, you bitch, you can't do that to me. But you know what? He came. And we sat in the east room that I had built on because the house wasn't big enough. And those folks did anything for me that I wanted. We had this wonderful east room. And he sat down and he confronted me. And he said, you know, that Barbara called me and she went on and on and on. And I told him what was wrong with her. And the next thing you know, the upshot of that meeting was that we sat down there in that east room. We bowed our heads. We prayed for Barbara. And he went back to Chicago. Wow. That's powerful stuff, I'm telling you. Man, I thought that. And all the time I'm thinking, you know, see, but that's kind of true. She was real close there. She was always handy. And I lay a dollar to donut. A lot of you alcoholics in this room took it out on the people close to you, too. Picked on them. It was their fault. If they hadn't been that way, then everything would have been okay. And I've said to her many times, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't drink. Her mother and one of the members of the church confronted me one Sunday in the office that I had built because it wasn't good enough. And they said, you know, we hear that you've been drinking a lot. And I told my mother-in-law because I knew that she and Barbara didn't get along too well. I said, anybody married to a daughter like yours would drink anyhow. So I got her on my side, too. And it worked out pretty good. I used to take booze with me to the pastor's conferences. I would take my gin and my Coke, you know, right along with me. And I don't know if anybody ever sat around and listened to a bunch of preachers talk all day. It'll drive you crazy. So I would offer some of my friends, I said, y'all want to go up and have a little drink? And they would say no. And I'd think, well, you people, it doesn't matter with you. You don't want to have any fun or anything like that? Because I finally got to the point that fun to me was drinking. Having a good time was going out and getting drunk. It was never being with the people that you like and enjoying each other and having a good time with the wife and the family and things like that. That was nothing. Those were just little sidelines as far as I was concerned, because the most important thing was drinking. I don't know if you know it, but as a preacher, you know, I could get the first draft communion wine. Now, that's nothing like this little cheap stuff you buy in the store today, you know, where they put the coloring in it, they add the sugar and everything. This is first draft pure communion wine. And I had that in little bottles all behind all the Bibles in the office. And every time I'd come in, you know, I'm going to read a little scripture here. Take a little drink there. See? Here's my prayer list. I need to say a few prayers here and have a couple there. And, you know, by the time I got home, I was between the sheets at night and all kinds of stuff. But I need to tell you something. The people in the church that I served when all of this happened over that period of many years loved me. I was good. And I was good to them. Now, you can believe this or not, but I would get up because I couldn't sleep, I think, was the problem. But I always had a little pocket full of parsley. And I'd go to the hospital at 2 or 3 in the morning. And I would chew that on the way to the hospital, about 13 miles. Get there and spit it out in the parking lot. Go in and visit these folks. Wake them up. Pray with them. Have a great time, you know. And they would go back and tell everybody, we have such a wonderful pastor. He has dedicated his life to us. And so forth. So I pretty well had those folks on my side. They had me up on a pedestal way up here. And I guess over a period of time what happened was that the air got kind of thin. And I couldn't handle that kind of success. And I learned, you know, when I came into the program that there wasn't much that I could handle. That the best that I could do would be to take a deep breath every day, you know, hopefully. And that maybe there was a possibility that things would get better. I started to be the first one to commune at the church. Now, in the Lutheran church, we use wine for communion. I used to be the gentleman pastor. I'd wait till everybody else would commune, and then I would. But I did it first then, because it kind of got me going. It gave me a little tingle inside, and it kept me going as far as the service. Many a time I stood in that pulpit and preached to those people, drunk as you could be. And I envisioned myself as John the Baptist coming to life. Really up there laying the sin and the guilt on those folks, you know, and telling them they ought to be ashamed of themselves for being out there drinking like they do. They ought to apologize and repent of their sins and get over it. Okay. I also remember that I was passing out money to the kids, which was unheard of. I didn't have it to give, but I did that anyhow. I shortened the services and the meetings to say, you know, we don't need to spend all this time talking about this stuff. Just do what I ask you to do, and we'll go home and rest. And then that's about the way the thing turned out, okay? Okay. I also had a wonderful schedule for buying my booze. I always wore my collar. And I had 5 towns around the community where we lived. And I always wore my collar. And I always picked out the stores that were operated by Catholics. Because, you see, I could walk in that store and they would say, well, hello, Father. And I would say, well, I'm not a father. I got 8 kids. They never caught on to that thing. And then I would tell them something like this. You know, the bishop is going to be coming for a very special meeting at our church, at our parish. And, you know, he does like to have a little bit of drink once in a while. And our parish, and I think the whole Catholic Church, would be grateful to you if you would consider giving us a discount. And so I got all my booze 25% off. I mean, yeah. You talk about converting to Catholicism? Oh, that was what I did. That was really great. And I remember, this is a good one now, that I was lying on the floor in the dining room one Saturday. I had my collar on, and I really wasn't bothering anybody. I was just laying there more so than anything else. And I remember that my wife came up and she kicked me right in the ribs. And she said, get up. You're sick. We're going to the hospital. So I got up. And I got in the car. And she and somebody else took me over to the Swedish American Hospital in Rockford, Illinois. Walked in the door and she said to the lady at the desk there, 4th floor, please. Well, I had been there many times visiting some of my own sickos. Yeah. She was going to take me into the psycho ward and have me committed because I was sick. So we sat in Dr. Henry's office, and she just carried on and on about 35 minutes, boo-hoo, crying, all this kind of stuff, you know. Told him everything that I ever did. And when she was done, he asked me, now, Reverend Killian, what do you have to say about all this? I sat up in my chair. I got out my best clergy voice. And I said to him, well, Dr. Henry, I'm really concerned about Barbara. And I said, you know, she's been acting like this for the last 5 or 6 years. And everybody in the church knows about it. And they're really concerned that something needs to be done about her. And the result of the whole thing was he kept her there. Kept her there for 30 days. Diagnosed her with severe depression. I wonder why. Okay. But while she was there, I went and talked to the important, and I told them, you know, the cheese has slipped off her cracker. you know, that she's rowing with only one oar these days. And when she gets out, I want you to love her and be kind to her and be gentle and patient and everything, but don't believe a word she tells you. And that's the way it was. Now, I don't mind telling you that I am truly ashamed of that type of behavior, but I want you all to hear something tonight. You want to know the power of addiction? You want to know the power of alcoholism? That it could take this guy who got into that terrible disease, that sickness, that mental craziness, and to take a wonderful person like that who had never, ever hurt me and get rid of her because she was a threat to my drinking. She has a lot more to say about some of that stuff that's happened, but I'll tell you that. You know, one of the things I noticed that we have been on a lot of Al-Anon conventions and things like that, and then when I would say something like that and tell that story, and when I was done with my part of the, I'd walk down the aisle and they'd say, "I hate you." You know, and they would say, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself." They would say, "God is going to get you for your behavior. You don't deserve that, you lousy rat." All those wonderful complimentary things that were really good for me. And I also remember what started to happen to me then as a pastor and the responsibilities that I had. I'll never forget the one night that I was drunk, of course, and I got this phone call from a young girl, and she said, "Pastor, I'm going to commit suicide. You need to come and talk to me." And I said, "Okay, babe, I'll be there right away." I laid back down on the bed and fell asleep. 10 minutes later, the phone rang again. She said, "Aren't you coming?" I said, "I couldn't find my shoes." And I laid back on the bed, and I fell asleep again. And I remember that the third time the phone rang, she just said, "Ain't no use calling you. I'm just going to kill myself." And that's the end of that story. And I said, "I'll be right there." But I never asked her where she lived. So I still don't know to this day who that was or whatever happened. Now, I didn't hear any reports, you know, about anybody committing them suicide, so I really don't know. I finally got to the point that I really couldn't be the kind of person that I wanted to. I had done a lot of lying, a lot of manipulating, a lot of deceiving, and all that kind of stuff. And I need to tell you that when things finally came to the point that they came to a head, guilt almost destroyed my life. Shame. And if you want to talk about somebody that's shame-based, you're looking at the guy right here. I did not know what to do. I did not know who to turn to. I didn't know what was happening or anything else. And all during this time when I was out doing my drinking and all that kind of stuff, the four horsemen that had mentioned in the big book began to stalk me. There was the terror and the despair and the frustration and the bewilderment. And all of those things began to crowd into my life. And I didn't know what to do because I felt so helpless and I felt so hopeless and I was so full of fear and I became paranoid. But I kept telling myself, "It's going to be okay. You can handle it. All you have to do is just quit drinking and then everything's going to be okay." As a matter of fact, that's what Barbara kept telling me. "If you would just quit drinking, everything would be wonderful." I later found out something very important, that I did quit drinking. It was pitiful because we had a little conflict there and so forth. Now, Barbara and the children did not want to be around me. Everything was falling apart. So I did what any good, reasonable, sensible alcoholic would do. I ran away. I had a rental car. I found out later I had golf clubs. And I was in South Carolina. And for the next 2 or 3 weeks, I haven't the slightest idea what happened. But I do believe the people who told me about the things that I did. And there's one thing that really stuck out in my mind that I do remember, because I woke up the next morning and saw it, that while I was in that blackout, I resigned my position as the pastor of that church. And I remember looking at that letter and I say, what the heck is this, you know? But I had sent the letter, and I had resigned as the pastor of that church. I didn't know what to do. You know, you have to go until you go. There was no way that I could go back home. There was no way that I could go and face my wife. There was no way that I could go back and face those children. So I did what any 48-year-old alcoholic would do. I went home to mommy. That long umbilical cord, I guess, is really there and so forth. Yeah. I couldn't face life or anything like that. So I went home, and I was sick, and I was in despair, and I didn't know what to do. But I found out one, it takes what it takes. It takes what it takes to get us to the point that we can surrender and do something that's worthwhile in our life. So on May the 25th of 1974, I was out in the backyard, and I cooked these wonderful steaks. And incidentally, in those days, I could eat a 32-ounce porterhouse, no problems, that type of thing. And I remember that I had two beers. Gin was always my thing. But I had two beers, and I went to bed early that night. And on the morning of the 26th of May in 1974, I was lying in the dark, dank, humid-filled basement at my parents' home, lying on the bed. It was getting close to 8 o'clock, and it was time for the preacher to get up and to go to church. But the interesting thing was that I could not get out of that bed. My legs worked, my arms worked, but I want to tell you, this was gone. And so was this. And what I did was that I pondered that a little bit, you know, and I thought, does there come a time when God forces you to face reality? And I thought, what have you done with the life that God has given you? And then I spoke three words that were the hardest words for me to speak in my whole life at that time. And I said, I need some help. That's what it took for me to lose myself, to lose everyone that really cared about me, to have nothing left in my pocket, to wonder if there would ever be anything. I had no position. I wasn't working. I had nothing. You know, and I fought my battle with the bottle and with God, and I thought to myself at that point, God won. Everything's going to be okay, and everything will be cool. So they put me in the Lutheran General Hospital. I was one of the first preachers they put in treatment years ago, and I thought that was a real credit to myself, too, you know. Up in Park Ridge, Illinois. Now, you have to understand this, and I mean no offense to anybody that might have a problem with drugs other than alcohol, but what they did is that they took me and then they locked me up in the psychiatric ward with a bunch of drug addicts. And I thought to myself, now, there's got to be a mistake here. And one of the most humbling experiences of my life was when my aged parents came to bring me some stuff, and they looked through the window that had bars on it at their son, who they thought was so wonderful. Just brought me down. And I remember leaving that, and I took what they brought, I put it in my room, and I walked back out, and there was this young fellow there who walked up to me, and he had this real bad look on his face, like he was real mean. And he said, you mess with me, man, I'll cut your balls off. And I said, man, I don't want this to happen. So I went back in my room. I went back in my room fast, I'll tell you that, boy. And I'll tell you what, if I saw him, I'd close the door. I wasn't going to mess around with that guy. I spent 24 days there in a 21-day program, and I had a wonderful time there. It was exciting. I told those folks, I said, you know, that God has sent me here to be with you. That I can help you. And I can help you in the relationships because I'm good at marriage counseling. And I can get y'all, I promise you, everything will work out pretty good for you, you know, and so forth. And I'd set up appointments to meet with them, but they'd never keep them. And they finally told me that there's a real wonderful little country club treatment center next door for people that have a problem with alcohol. Now I said, yeah, I'll go. What the heck, I didn't have anything else to do. I was unemployed. So I went over there and had a wonderful time there. And some wonderful things happened when I left. You know, you got to appreciate this. That I remember that my counselor, who incidentally never took any time for me when I was there, took me in his office on the last day and he said, Russ, you are the classic example of a middle-aged alcoholic. And I thought to myself, how dare you talk to me like that? I hated the word alcoholic. I did not like the idea of middle-aged, but I love the word classic. Yeah. I challenge the whole group here then. How many of you have been called a classic alcoholic, see? But that was me. I was the classic alcoholic. And then he said this. He said, you know, the staff got together. We've been staffing you, as they call it. And we think that you're zany. And I remember that when I went to that treatment center, the first thing one of the guys said to me, one of the cons said, you know, Russ, you don't even have a conscience anymore. And I thought to myself, what do you know? You hear where I'm going, don't you? that I was humbled and things began to happen. Life is falling down. But the attitude hadn't changed yet. It was coming back just as strong as it ever was before. I was egotistical and arrogant, and it had to be my way or no way. And if you don't do it my way, hit the highway and just get out of my life and leave me alone. Well, I was highly offended when he said that about being zany, because that implies you're kind of crazy. Not to be outdone, I went to the library, got a Webster's Unabridged, looked it up, and sure enough, it implies there may be something wrong with you. But on the other hand, there's a second definition, and it says that a zany person is someone who brings excitement, enthusiasm, and exuberance into the lives of other people. And I thought, great, I got it going. That's who I was. My group told me, Russ, you are the philosopher of X group. And I thought to myself, well, this is wonderful. You know, I've really made my mark while I've been here, and everything is fine. And then I thought about that a little bit afterwards. And, you know, there's a story I came across that reminds me of what he was really saying. And it's about a couple of ladies who got together to celebrate their 25th year of graduation from high school. And this one lady was all dolled up, and she had all these fancy clothes on and all that kind of stuff. And there was another gal, her friend at that time years ago, who was rather plain, common, ordinary type of thing. And so this gal that was real fancy started to talk to her, and she said, well, what's going on? You know, do you, oh, it's okay. Well, look here, do you know what my husband did for me when we got married? No, took me on a 3-month cruise in the Mediterranean for honeymoon. The lady looked at her and said, that's fantastic. She said, you know what else he did? He bought me a 17-room house, servants and all. The other lady said, fantastic. Said, you know, he also gave me this big ring for my 25th anniversary here. And the lady looked at it and said, that is really fantastic. And then the conversation kind of switched a little bit, and the fancy lady turned to Helen. She said, Helen, how you been? Oh, it's been okay. Did your husband ever do anything special for you? And she thought for a moment. And then she said, yes, he did. He sent me to charm school. And she said, well, what did you learn in charm school? She said, I learned to say fantastic instead of bullshit. Well, I tell you. Hey, that's wild. I can't believe they said that about me, but they did. Okay. And then I think the crowning thing of all when I was in treatment or just getting out of treatment was that they came to me and they said, Russ, we want you for research. And I thought, this is great, you know, that they were going to have all these researches, you know, write a book and I'd live off the royalties, who needs to be a preacher anymore, and all that kind of stuff. I went in there and sat for a day and a half, tell a little, recorders whizzing and taken apart from top to bottom as far as attitude, all that kind of good stuff, behavior, everything. Never heard from them since then. Haven't heard a word about what that research was all about. But here's what they told me when I left there. Said, you know, you need to go to 3 AA meetings a week. That's how I got exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So in the Chicago area at that time, there were 524 different meetings to choose from. And I want to tell you about the power and the wisdom of a God of my understanding. That of the 3 meetings that I chose, every one of them was a step meeting. And I have learned that the steps are recovery. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is wonderful. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the people. If I ever had a choice, you know, of hanging around with earth people or hanging around with you, I'd take you any time because there's something there, and we know that without even saying it. Okay? And I thrived on that. In Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you all probably know that after a while you can get pissed off at somebody. You get upset with somebody. You don't like it because somebody talks all the time. You don't like what they're saying and so forth and so on. But you can't quibble with the success of the 12 steps. Because when you do that, it says that you will have a spiritual awakening as the, not a, but the. That's the absolute result. The result, a spiritual awakening. And for me, that was something that I desperately needed. There had to be something in life that was more important than I was, and I couldn't see that. See, when you talk about a relationship with God, let me tell you, I knew all about Him. I could sit down with anybody. I probably could still do it today if I wanted to, and take the book that some of you use and talk about all that stuff. But I'll tell you what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I came to know him. Not about him, but I came to know him on a very personal basis. And that has made a powerful difference in my life. So I started to learn some things when I went to that meeting. I learned that you can't fly a kite without a string. And I also learned you can't play an instrument without a wire, you know, on that thing. Can't steer a ship without a rudder. But I still had some problems with this thing called ego. Okay, and then, of course, I always wore my collar when I went to the meetings to be sure they knew who was there. And I remember one time when something happened that really brought me down, but that probably helped me more than anything else. I remember one time I tended not to want to sit in a circle with those people because I thought maybe a little bit below my level here and so forth, because I was an intelligent person. I knew all about alcoholism by now and everything. And you know what he told me? He looked me right in the eye and said, "You know, Reverend," he said, "you ought to get down off your high horse and come down here and join the rest of us. You'll be a lot happier." And he was right. When I got down off the high horse and I got down there, you know what happened to me? I started to be like the others. I didn't think that I was any better than anybody else. I didn't think that I was in charge of life. I didn't think that I had to have my way anymore. And if I made a mistake, it was okay for me to admit it and to move along and so forth. Okay. Well, about that time then, after going to these meetings, you know, I started to feel pretty good, and I had this great revelation. And the revelation was that I'm sure Barbara would like to see you again. Now, she will tell you what happened and where she was, but I finally tracked her down. She was out in New Richmond, Ohio, living in a little shack along a tributary of the Ohio River. And I remember going there, and she can tell you a lot about that because it's a lot of her story rather than mine. And I do remember that we had a lot of struggles. We had a lot of pain. We had a lot of arguments. She kicked me out and all that. But, you know, in spite of all that, something happened is that she started to go to Al-Anon. And I want to encourage, if it's possible for all of you here today, if it's possible and that's your circumstance, get better together. The opportunities are there. Get better to be comfortable walking and living in your own skin and learn to live a life, and you can still have a wonderful, exciting time together. But anyhow, she went to Al-Anon. And I think it's a great tribute to her and to you. And I want to take this few moments, if I can, to say something very positive and loving about a group that is called Al-Anon. What you have done to her and for her is just an awesome thing. It is absolutely indescribable as far as I can see. So you see, today, instead of calling Barbara the psycho bitch, I have nothing but respect for her. I cherish her presence in my life. And I will say this to her personally, to face to face, as I would to anybody in the world who's willing to listen, that she is indeed one of the greatest people that I have ever met in my life. It has been my privilege to live with her now under some very pleasant circumstances for quite a few years now. And I do endow her with my love, and I endow her with my goods, and I endow her with my presence. And I have even heard her on occasion to say that she may be glad that I'm still around. And I think that that's wonderful. I think together you have helped us to forge a bond that nobody can take away from us. And if we give it up, it's because we choose to give it up. And let me tell you that back in 1978, I went back up to Northern Illinois where my parents lived. They were both in their 80s. And we had decided that we're going to provide Mom and Dad with a place to stay until they died. And we did that. And we were happy to do that. And I remember on the 30th of January, 1980, that my dad was in the hospital. And I told Barbara, I said, "Well, you know, I'm going to go over to the hospital. I took a little snack and a newspaper. I'm going to stay with Dad tonight." And I remember walking in the room finding him dead. And those people at the hospital, very wonderful people. They put me in this little room, gave me a phone, and I had two brothers and a sister, and I had the 8 children that we have. And I called them and told them what happened, that Grandpa died. And my son lived in Rockford, Illinois, and he had a daughter lived down near St. Louis, rather. She had a little 2.5-year-old girl who's now in the Marines and the mother of my first great-grandchild. And she had a little 4.5-month-old baby boy by the name of Miles Benjamin. And they came down that night for the funeral. And that night, the little baby died of crib death in the house. Okay, and I need to tell you something, that my church people came, and you came. And you stayed with us the longest, and you prayed with us the best, and you held us the closest, and we will never, ever forget that as long as we live. That's what people in this program are all about. 3 years later, my mom died, and I had a little sister at the time, 39 years old, didn't know her very well. I preached my mother's funeral, which was a great experience for me. And my sister decided to stay a day over because we never really spent much time together. That night, she dropped dead in the house. And again, guess who was there? The church people came, but you came and you stayed the longest. You held us the closest and you prayed the most delightfully and the most sincerely. And we're not going to forget that. You held us close and we love you for that. And we're not going to forget that. That's an inspiration, I think, for everybody today. So I began to learn something through all of this as time went by, and it does take time. I learned that Alcoholics Anonymous is a community of action. It's not just talk. So I spent a lot of time those first years of my recovery being an Alcoholics Anonymous. I never hid the truth from the churches where I served or anything like that. And I learned, you know, that every bird whistles through his own beak, that my sobriety is my job, but I need your help. And the first thing I noticed, the most powerful thing I noticed, is that if you want to get better, you got to change your attitude. So I read a neat story once about a Texan, 6'8", 280 pounds, met this little 5'4" brunette, fell madly in love with her, courted her, proposed, wonderful, wonderful. Had a nice wedding, went over to the nearby town, honeymoon suite, got there. He goes in the bathroom to get ready for what's about to happen on the honeymoon night, comes out with a big pair of blue jeans, flips them, says, "Put those pants on." She gets down there and says, "I can't wear these pants." He said, "As long as you remember that, we'll get along fine." He said, "I'll wear the pants in this family." Not to be outdone, she went in the bathroom to get ready. She came out with this little pair of panties, flipped them, and he said, "Put those panties on." He held them up and looked at them, and he said, "I can't get in these panties." And she said, "If you don't change your attitude, you never will." Amen. So, if you want the good stuff, you change your attitude. And I learned that the same thing is true of life. If you want the blessing and the joy and the happiness and joy and the freedom that our big book talks about, you got to change your attitude. And then follows upon that, I think, is our behavior. And the time came then that, I felt the need to get back in the ministry because I was out for about 20 months. Didn't do much of anything during that time. And they told me that I had to go see a preacher in Cincinnati. Now, this preacher was well known as a man who dealt with fallen clergy. Okay. So I went and I met with him. And we talked for a couple hours. He asked me all kinds of questions and so forth and so on. And about a half an hour after we were finished with that interview, he came in and he told me, "Russ," he said, "I'm really sorry to tell you this, but you're just not going to make it." And I was depressed, and I was sad, and I was unhappy, and I was mad. And I remember going home, and I got to tell you this, and if you think that God can't handle things, that 3 weeks after that happened, I got a call to a church in Erlangen, Kentucky, and I got a call to a church in Enterprise, Alabama. And Barbara and I talked about this, and we decided, well, we're going to go down to Enterprise, okay? So that's how we got to down south here. The Saturday before we came down here, I drove past the preacher's house in Cincinnati and shot him a bird. I'll tell you what. Doggone it. Now, when will they learn that? When will they learn the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it can do? and how God restores us to sanity and chooses His own ways to do that. Anyhow, today I see life as a wonderful gift from God, and I have discovered that there's a God, and that His name is not Russell. And I know that He will not do for me what I need to do for myself. So I want to thank everybody here personally for all the help and all the guidance that you've offered me and all of the ways you've shown me that I could change my attitude, that I could be a different person, that I didn't have to live the way that I lived before. Today I need to tell you that He's my God. He's not my slave. He's not my supply sergeant. He's my God. He's my higher power. And then I noticed, too, that my relationships have improved. I can only say this in the way I see it with my children. My kids are great because many of them over the years have confronted me, and they would tell me things like this: Dad, you were never there for us. When I had the lead in the class play, you were never there for us. When we had our games, you were never there. You were always drunk on your butt someplace. And we've been able to work through that. And our children today, all of them, love to have Barbara and I come and to be with them, because we treat them with the respect that they deserve. And they respond to that because they see what changes have taken place, particularly in my life. And I want to tell you, if you want relationships to improve, that can happen. I read this neat little story about two Swedish people named Sven and Olga. And they were having a lot of trouble in their married life, and they spent about 40 years not even talking to each other. And finally, Olga said, Sven, this has got to stop. This is not working. We need to do something. One of us needs to pray to God to take the other one, and then I'll go live with my sister. my goodness. When you get better, instead of doing that, you celebrate things together. You just celebrate life. You celebrate each other, and you enjoy the company of each other, and things get pretty good that way. I need to tell you all tonight that in spite of everything, you know, that I am still teachable. I am still willing to learn. There's a lot of things I'm sure that I do not know about how things can be different for me. I cherish and hang on with every ounce at my command to the promises in the big book. And I especially love the one that says we will intuitively know how to handle things that used to baffle us. I was so baffled for so long, and now I know what's a federal case and what isn't. And if I have trouble trying to figure it out, I got all kinds of people who are with me, and they'll say, well, how about this, and so forth, and so on. For those of you that use that book, you know, as your spiritual guidance and everything, there's a wonderful story about the prodigal son. Here, you're looking at one right here. The one who went into a far country of alcoholism and wasted my substance with riotous drinking. But he came to his senses. And I thank God for that, and I thank you for that. And then he came back. You know what his dad did? He forgave him. And he put a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet and a robe on his back. All of them signs and symbols that he was accepted once again as his son. And every time any of you hear that old gospel song, Amazing Grace, it's talking about me. And it's talking about you. That we were dead, but now we're alive. We were lost, but now we have been found. Gosh. Today I can let God be the father, and I'm willing to be the child. That's important to me. I don't have to be in control. I don't have to know everything like I used to. I had a wonderful sponsor over the years, and here's what he told me, something powerful and dynamic. He said, Russ, incidentally, he was not one from the old school of hard knocks. He was one of the most gentle men I ever met, and that's exactly what I needed because I was so ridden inside. And he would say, well, why don't you give this some thought? Maybe you could take a look at this and see what happened. But I never forget one time a statement made. I said, you know, Russ, in AA we have an H of a program, and we do. First of all, there's honesty. There is nothing in my life than when I started to be honest with myself, and I did not like what I saw. But you said, you have to deal with it. You have to become honest with yourself. And in the chapter 5 of the big book, you know, it says that the people that don't make it are the ones that really can't be honest with themselves. We have another H called humility. I have learned my limitations. I cannot be everything all the time to everybody. I also realize that I have a sensitivity now to the needs of other people that I never had before. I thank you for that too. And I also realize where it all comes from. There's a power greater than I am who has given me these kinds of gifts. There's a thing called hope. For everybody here that may wonder whether or not your issues are so beyond control that it'll never get better, may I humbly remind you that there is hope. Hang on to that and don't give that up. There's also a thing called humanity. I thank you very much because you gave my name back. I'm Russ. Years ago, nobody dared call me that, boy. I was the pastor, period. And if anybody called me anything but that, I'd take them off to the side and give them a little lecture. Let them know. Thank you very much for giving me back my name. I'm grateful for that. And then there was a thing that is called humor. I love Alcoholics Anonymous because we can laugh at ourselves. That was the greatest thing in the world, to be able to laugh at the craziness we got into. I'll never forget that when I got drunk, one of my favorite things to do was that I would put on these wonderful fancy gowns I had, you know, the black, and you put this white cassock over here and put the stole on here and put a cross here, maybe a little cincture, you know, colored. Oh, that was great. And then I'd get on my bicycle and ride around town. and have a good time. Jeez. That was until I heard that they were looking for some crazy guy riding around town in his nightgown. And so then I finally quit. As I've said before, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard something the other day that sticks with, it's not what you've lost, it's what you have left. And what I have left is far superior to anything that I had before. I've gotten back the things that I so stupidly and crazily gave up with my alcoholism. I am still an alcoholic, and I will always be that. But I have something today that nobody can take away from me, and that is that I am free. I am free today to be the kind of person that my Creator intended me to be before. I'm not perfect, but I'll tell you what, I'm working real hard. Let me tell you about a little story about a couple of grasshoppers, and I'll be done here shortly. There was two grasshoppers, and they fell in this bowl of thick, rich cream. And this first grasshopper said, "Holy smokes, man, am I ever in trouble? This is pitiful. This is disgusting. I had never been in a mess like this before." And he just kept feeling sorry for himself and moaning and groaning about what happened. And you know that he drowned in that bowl of thick, rich cream. And the second grasshopper fell in that bowl of thick, rich cream, and he said, "Holy smokes, am I ever in trouble? Man, I better do something fast, or I'll never get out of this thing alive." So he started kicking up his little grasshopper heels and singing a little grasshopper song. First thing you know, he turned that cream into solid butter. And he walked away to safety. I beg of all of you to take a look at which one you are. If you want to be like grasshopper number one, you can. You can spend a lot of your time sitting on your pity pot. But I promise that the only thing you'll get is a ring around your hiney. Yeah. And if you sit there long enough, your ring will get callous. And if it gets callous, you won't have any feelings. If you don't have any feelings, you might as well be dead. Because we're feeling people. Or you can be grasshopper number two. You can just kick up your little old heels and sing up these little wonderful 12-step songs that we have. Get a good, firm foundation in your life. And things have a way of getting better. You become one day at a time stronger, and then you just kind of trudge along on that happy road of destiny. And in the process, you become happy and you become joyous, and you also become very free. Many years ago, Oliver Wendell Holmes said this: "Most people die with their music still in them." And he was probably right. I want to tell everybody here tonight, we have the greatest symphony that anybody in this world could produce. And it would be tragic if any one of you, or if this guy up here, ever failed to let that music out. Because it can touch the lives of everyone, and it can make them different. It can be wonderful. I read this little poem, and I think it's great. It says, "The wonderful love of a beautiful maid, the love of a staunch true man, the joys of a baby unafraid have existed since life began. But the greatest of these, the love of loves, even greater than that of a mother, is the passionate, tender, and infinite love of one drunken bum for another." That's powerful. Okay? So let me tell you something. I want to thank you for letting me be here and sharing with you tonight. But I want to tell you what. I'm flying and I'm soaring because of what AA has done. And I'm flying higher than an eagle. And I invite all of you to come and join me. Thanks a lot.